Hey, movie lovers, welcome back to another Anatomy of Movie here on Popcorn Talk Network. Today, we return for a sequel, the first ever for Antoine Fuqua, as well as Denzel Washington. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Today we dissect Equalizer 2. I have Dimitri Panos here alongside
me. Hey, movie fans. Hey, Phil. Hey, I have a question. When we just did that first take, was that live?
Let's not worry about that.
Oh, come on. That was funny.
It was, but the fans on demand are like, what the hell's going on? Nothing's going on except for the fact that we're dissecting movies. I'm Phil Svitek. It's Equalizer 2. And for those of you unfamiliar with the show, first off, spoiler warning, we're going to talk about the movie as if you've seen it. So if you haven't, be forewarned. If you don't care, which I know some of you guys don't, then hey, stick around. Also, if you want to follow along, we do have our rundown in the description. It's a little PDF that you guys get to download and follow along with us. And thirdly, we are not necessarily a review show. We talk about it from the perspective where we do discuss storylines, so you're not lost there. We do that. However, we also talk about the production, the how and the why, and then certainly go into box office and the how and the why of that as well. Which, first off, congrats to Equalizer 2 for being number one in the box office.
It was. I mean, it pulled off a sleep. It was the, what do you call it in horse racing? You pulled off a...
an upset.
An upset. Nobody thought that the movie was going to do as well and be number one.
Yes, indeed. Before we get to any of that, though, we must start with overall thoughts. So, Dimitri, what did you think of this movie?
Well, I was a fan of the first movie. First, I was a fan of the show. It's a fun show. And bringing it... to the big screen, having Denzel play that character, McCall, it was a really great idea. And working together with Antoine Fuqua, it's amazing that neither one of them, but particularly Denzel Washington, who's been in his career, is just insane. Now, this is his first sequel.
Yeah.
Ever. So, you know, with Antoine Fuqua and the times that he's worked with Denzel, you can sort of understand why there might not have been a sequel, because, well, Denzel usually just makes it to the end and he usually dies. So no sequel for those movies, like Training Day. But going into the Equalizer 2, I enjoyed this movie. And in parts, even a little bit more than the first one, I felt that this one had, now that the story was given to us, the origin story, so to speak, this one had a little more emotional heft to it, which I really appreciated. And the action, I think, where many said that it was extremely violent, it is. I didn't find it any more violent than Sicario 2. And in fact, I thought it was even less violent than the first Equalizer movie. But the action scenes were really well done. And I think it's important to note here that part of what sells the action is Denzel. Like, there wasn't a moment when I'm watching this movie, when I'm seeing him do these fights and such, that I didn't believe it was him. You know, I mean, and at his age, I think that's tremendous. And the believability factor is important to carry an action movie. And you can tell that he was doing a lot of his own fight scenes. I thought that he sells that a lot. And there wasn't a time where I did not believe he couldn't handle the situation that he was in, that Denzel Washington couldn't do that. So kudos to him. My only critique of this is that I didn't quite get what was going on with this other faction. Like, the incident that starts the story, what's to be the main story, because we have like an A plot and a B plot here, but the main story with this couple who get killed and it's set up like a suicide, they're involved in something, but I never quite understood what this something was and why and what's going on. And when the reveal comes, I was like, okay, but I still didn't know what was going on, really. And I just knew that Denzel was going to, you know, he started war with these folks. It wasn't really a twist when it was revealed who the bad guy is. Yeah. But that didn't matter for the most part, because Denzel was doing what Denzel can do, and I thought he carried the movie. I thought Fuqua's direction was really spot on for this action movie. Doesn't rely on a lot of shaky cam and things like that. We're really brought into the action very well, almost arty. So on the whole, I had a good time watching Equalizer 2 for a sequel.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So this was my first Equalizer. I did not see the first. And, you know, overall, with its slow pace initially, it took me a while to kind of understand everything. Like, I was trying to read more into things than they were.
Mm-hmm.
It was just kind of, it was what it was, and I thought for some reason there was a deeper meaning. And then once I understood, oh, it is what it is, then I got into it, and it was a lot of fun. I have to say, the B plot for me was, when you talk about an emotional heft, that was the more interesting part of everything.
Which plot? The one with the old man the college kid?
Well, you can take both as the B plot, because basically the B plot is him as a Lyft driver in sure. Boston and just doing his thing.
Yeah.
Which I thought that to me was more interesting, because Denzel is just so great at just being a human. I don't know how else to describe it.
He is. He has this presence, and it particularly when he's with kids, right? This happened with Man on Fire, his relationship with Dakota Fanning. In that movie, young Dakota Fanning. But you're right. There is this humanistic quality that Denzel exudes that you just buy into, and you sort of kind of, you melt with it when he bonds with that kid or even the old man. And yet he still has enough screen presence and charisma that when he gets down and dirty and violent, you buy that too. That's a special trait for an actor to be able to carry off.
Well, it's kind of... Why it works for me is that whenever he's protecting anyone, or that his violence comes from the fact that someone's being wronged,
mm-hmm.
and so the fact that we've seen him to such depth as of humanity, you know, it makes sense why he cares so deeply, and so that's what I appreciated. And, you know, the only thing, like the pacing was a little bit off, because we don't really get into the main plot until like 50 minutes into the mm-hmm. movie. I mean, we get little bits here and there, but none of it, you're like, okay, what's going on? None of it really makes sense until, oh, okay. And as you said, like, you were confused, and I think part of it is because we spend so little time on that. It becomes secondary, even though it's primary.
Yeah, and let us not forget how the movie almost bookends, right? Because we start off on this train, like, you know,
in Turkey,
right? And it's an extraction of this girl. And that has a nice... That gets tied up very nicely. But to your point, there's this really nice scene because he goes to this bookstore a lot. This collectible bookstore. And there's this really nice rapport with this little girl where he's like, shh. And the girl, because he saved the girl, but it's a secret to the mom. And again, you just buy into it. And this is what the first movie didn't have a lot of that I respected and appreciated more in the sequel. And again, it's because Denzel's able to pull that off really well.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I gotta say, like for me, Denzel and Miles, who was also in Moonlight. Ashton Sanders is his actual name.
Mm-hmm.
Those two really stole the show for me.
Yeah.
I think that's what worked. And I, you know, what I did appreciate in terms of the plotting was the fact that the A and the B storyline did come together in the third act where they kidnap Miles, and it's like, okay, now you've double messed up.
Right. Yeah. But I also liked his relationship. Well, again, it got a little bit deeper with, Melissa Leo's character, Susan Plummer, you know, there was this very, I found it to be a very touching scene where, you know, you'll learn that McCall had lost his wife and he's still going through the emotional scars of that and how Melissa Leo, as a friend, comes by. I thought their relationship actually became fuller in this movie, along with the relationship with Susan Plummer's husband, who was played by Bill Pullman.
Mm-hmm.
It's always good for me, too, to see Bill Pullman on screen.
Great actor.
So those humanistic moments, you're right, I think help carry this And it makes the violence a little more palpable because you know from where, you know where this guy's coming from and why he's got to do the things he has to do. Now, even when we talk about violence, I thought the first Equalizer movie was far more violent than this one.
Well, here's a trivia fact. Denzel only shoots a gun once.
Uh-huh.
Which I know there's more gunfire than that.
Yeah.
Certainly the quote-unquote suicide.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty brutal in and of itself. But nonetheless, he only shoots the gun once and he harpoons another guy. So I guess you can call that a gunshot just with a bigger gun. But his, yeah, you mentioned his action style is very much hand-to-hand combat.
Yes.
And he excels at it quite well. I mean, if I had to pick, let's say, his favorite action scene, I really loved him going back because of the girl to the, whoever they were, the almost like college frat guys, even though they necessarily weren't.
Right. Yeah.
And he just writes that wrong.
Levels them. And the scene in the train, too. Mm. I found to be really good. You know, and it's great because Antoine Fuqua worked, and Denzel, they worked, there was a stunt coordinator, Jeff Dashnaw, and he built those action sequences, the close-up hand-to-hand, around, catch this, Denzel's talents. And because McCall's speed is so very fast, the stunt coordinator, Jeff, says, we have to shoot in a lot of cuts. And if he does it all at once, he goes, he'll do it so well, we'll never see what he does. And I think sometimes directors, when they're filming a scene like that, they do forget about that. How many times have we talked about action movies where we go, what the hell's happening here? Just keep the, like, I want to know. And we don't get that in, like, say, the John Wick movies, too, because Keanu is so well-trained. But when we're talking about Denzel, Denshaw says he's actually really fast with his hands. He picks up the action and choreography really quickly, and he attributes this, because I didn't know, Denzel has been boxing for most of his life. And so they add some of that there, and that gives him a lot of the disciplines for that hand-to-hand combat. So the choreographer, Mick Gold, has some very special skills that he's been working with and working onto the film. So it makes it look a little, it's definitely not John Wick, right? Because like you said, he only shoots a gun once. But I think that the fight scenes are intense. They can be intense and brutal. And you know that the bad guy's going to get a big whoop-ass on them.
Yeah. It's more cerebral.
And
yeah. I mean, John Wick has elements of that too, but this in particular, you know, and in fact, there's direct shots, whether they kind of zoom in on his eye and you see from his peripheral of what's happening. So there's a calculation there happening that we get to witness, and I very much appreciate.
It's funny you mentioned that too, because Fuqua calls that specifically equalizer vision. He goes, where his heart slows down, his pupils dilate, more light comes in, and his vision gets sharper, and he's more aware of the room and his surroundings. And he's like, violence is a comfort zone for McCall. So it's funny you bring that up, because I was just on a page talking about equalizer vision.
Well, you know, too, it's their element as well. Like Denzel in his own right has done very gritty movies.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly some of them he's done with Fuqua, you know, Training Day in particular. Obviously Equalizer, the first one. But
Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, I mean, they live in that realm, so to speak. And, you know, I don't think he's duplicating a performance of any other kind apart from Robert McCall, let's say. But he's able to draw into that spirit that he's been, like, even I go back to, like, He Got Game with Spike Lee. Like, that's a very dark character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a father.
Yeah. Well, even Man on Fire, you know, is a gritty, dark movie, too. But Denzel's able to carry it off because he utilizes all of his experience as an actor. You know, this is a man that's been in comedies, he's been in heavy dramas, and he's able to bring all of this, whether it's timing and his drama chops, and now working with these action movies, whether it's a Magnificent Seven or an Equalizer, but I think all of his experience comes through, and he uses them all. He doesn't change just because this is an action movie. He still is able to carry off dramatic scenes, which make him more humanistic, which I think draws an audience in more.
Yeah. Well, speaking of using all the elements, like the scene I mentioned prior at the hotel room with the, again, I'll just call them the college frat guys, even though they aren't. That's a very comedic scene. He's like, rate me 5 stars on Lyft. You better rate me 5 stars. And just the way that kept being a running gag in that scene, and then the button at the end where he receives the 5-star rating. Yeah. It's a good little bit of comedy in an otherwise very dark movie.
Sure. Yeah.
So it has all those elements.
I like the scene too. Again, just going back to the train sequence. He dispatches of everybody in the train. And again, this is a brutal fight scene. I think we talked about this a little bit when we were talking Skyscraper and brutal fight scenes. And I always refer back to James Bond. There were 2 big fight scenes in a train that are really hand-to-hand, very brutal. And that scene in the train when he dispatches everyone except for the one guy. Anyway, he says something to the effect of, pain can be 2 things. You can realize from it, or you can hurt from it. Which one do you want? You know, I mean, he's going to do something. So that it was such a great line. And then we don't see what if the guy picked and what happened to him.
You know, so it's you don't need to. Over.
Yep, yep.
I mean, a lot of some of the action really works on just the imagination. I mean, we get the kill with the wife to set up the A plot, and that's brutal to watch. But then we stand until the last moment of the gunshot of her husband, and then we just get the blood, which mm-hmm. that's all you really need at that point. You don't. I think it would have been less impactful had they actually shown it at that point.
Yeah, and I have a feeling there could have been a couple of edits. To your points, which you said earlier, it was brutal. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if there were a couple of frames here, a couple of frames there, taken out to get these R rated. So
let's dive into the A plot, shall we?
Sure, sure.
So in essence, the people that he worked with now were sort of fired, and in essence, they're just doing their own thing, right? They're hired guns, basically. Now, the interesting part is that what the movie didn't quite explore is that they're really no different than Robert McCall, except he has a different code than they do.
Yeah, they were all, if I was paying attention, they were all in the military together. Don't know if they were Navy SEALs or secret ops kind of thing, but you get that they were pretty tough hombres, right? And they did their job, and then they had no job. And something had happened, and it left Robin McCall to be perceived as dead. He was out. And by doing so, it changed the dynamic of this unit, leaving them sort of kind of in the wind, trying to do things, and they were bitter about that. So they were mercenaries, for lack of better words, or they were assassins, or they...
Well, as they described it,
ties up loose ends.
Your name on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So I gotta kill you. That's the paper I was given. I don't know who you are, what you do. I just gotta kill you. Because the paper says so.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, yeah, very much different, you know, and they do try to bring it up of, like, you did the same thing. Like, we received pieces of paper, and we didn't really question it. So I thought that was something, again, that could have been a little bit more explored.
I felt that it could have. A lot more, actually. Just so we had a better sense, because those other plots we were talking about, those were the type of plots that you would have found in the television show. I mean, it was an episodic series, lasted for a while, hour long. And, you know, getting back a kidnapped daughter, helping an old man retrieve a print for his memories, for his own sanity, helping a college boy stay on the right path. These are, when you break it down, you think about it, they're somewhat episodic in nature, right? This other plot is a little bit bigger. That's the movie, quote unquote, plot. And I wish they took a little more time, to your point, to flesh it out a little more. I would have liked that. to figure out why. Like, what the hell is going on here? Because McCall chose to be dead for a reason. And now his life is helping other people. So these other people, they went astray and they felt they weren't getting paid enough. It always comes down to money.
Well, they also said, you know, one of the things that was brought up was all they were sent was to the VA, and that was of no help. Mm-hmm. So there's a very, much like Foucault's movies, there's a political undertone, but it's really hidden deep and it doesn't make it to the surface too much, apart from just kind of glossing over it.
And they were your bad guys.
Yeah.
You know? That was it. I wish I agree with you. I wish that was fleshed out more.
But, you know, I think we've talked about this a number of times. The strongest villains are the ones that you really understand. You know, I'm not going to spoil Avengers, but like Thanos, you get his plight. You could look at Unforgiven and, you know, William Money and Little Bill Dagg. Like, you get it.
Sure.
And what's interesting, and especially for a movie like this, you want to make the line a little bit blurred, and the more blurred you make it of like, wait, who is the bad guy?
Right.
That's what makes it so much fun. And then, you know, the last act really becomes the divide, and it's like, and you tell the truth of, okay, what is their difference, and why is this guy the protagonist, and this guy has to be killed because, you know, of that one small difference.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And, it just wasn't as explored, unfortunately. But there was that little comedic moment, like it actually has more comedy than we give it credit. When they're in the standoff, and they're like
in the neighborhood,
yes. And then he just says, "Hey, your husband told me you're going to give me a ride to the airport." Okay,
okay.
We'll see you guys later. Yeah, that was just a great way to get out of a situation.
And you know, not so we're in this situation, and Denzel's like, "No, you're not going at war with me. I'm going to war with you. So come on. We'll see how this pans out." And it was all done, like, they're all smiles because they're in the middle of a suburban neighborhood. And when he says, "Yeah, you give me a ride to the airport," they're like, it's like, okay, that'll be great. I'd love to get to know you more. It's like, all right, guys, I'll see you soon.
Yeah, I thought that was a fun scene.
It was a good scene. It was the exposition scene. But, yeah, I thought it was a really bad things you saw were potentially going to happen there. And I liked, because if memory serves, because I saw the movie over a week ago, I've seen a lot since, he then goes to rescue Bill Pullman, right? Mm-hmm. Does he go there? He doesn't go back to Boston. He goes back to Virginia, I believe.
Yeah, he goes there first to pull him out, save his life, because he's technically a loose end.
Yeah.
And then he goes back to Boston. Unfortunately, he shows just a little bit late.
Yeah.
And it's the kid. Kid had to just leave the hiding hole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he just only stayed a little bit longer.
I always love it when movies film in Boston, too. And they really got a good cross-section of Boston. You see, everything is so familiar if you're from the city and you spend as much time in the city as I did. But it's great. I always like it when they show you different parts of the city. And this movie utilized Boston really well.
Yeah, primarily the South End they used as a locale.
Yeah, yeah, I liked it.
So, for those familiar, South End is different than South Feet, by the way.
Yes, absolutely.
So, just a note. Yeah, and I did like that neighborhood aspect, you know, it as a movie, right? Like, I feel like Denzel stands for something more than just himself, right? And he carries that, and we've talked a little bit about that. But when you look at this movie and the idea of living in an urban environment and how you should respect it, and, you know, he helps the lady with the garden, as you said, like these mini morals, if you will.
Yeah.
I appreciate that and how he's able to turn Miles. And by the way, one of the more intense scenes was when he busts out a gun on Miles after getting him out. And he's like, "Yeah, you want to go?
Yeah.
You want to be a tough guy? Shoot me."
Yep.
I didn't know how that was going to play out.
It was a good scene. And again, it could have been a scene that was a hell of a lot, that could have gone south, could have been a lot more violent. But him busting them out, I thought they were all going to come out and chase him, and I thought it was going to turn into an action set piece. never really happened that way.
No.
Not that I would have minded some bad drug-dealing thugs to get their comeuppance from McCall and Denzel beating them. But that scene, it was a really good scene. It worked for me. And again, it was that emotional heft that the first one had some of, but not as much here. The relationships, the human relationships that McCall had. And you really got that he wanted to help and save people if he could.
Yeah.
If they would listen.
Well, speaking of emotional heft, the action set piece, the climax of the movie, is in his former house.
Right.
It's where he, you know, let's say grew up, whatever the case, right?
Well, it's where he, it's where he spent a good part of his life with his wife.
Yeah. And I thought as an action set piece, it was utilized very well, but it, as far as the emotional heft of him returning, and him returning to then use it as a final standoff against this, I don't know, maybe you just have to take it in and just understand that, but just the movie itself didn't fully bring that to light.
Yeah. I mean, I think thematically it was, well, I even think that, who was it? I think that it was Pedro Pascal's David York had said, he's going home. I know where he's going. He's going home. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. He hadn't been home in years, and it was still his home in this quiet seaside community that could have been Newburyport or could have been Cape Cod. It looked like any one of those. Nahant, actually, it sort of looked like Nahant, too. You know, I just felt that it was him going home back to this seaside community that he hadn't been to in years. And I felt to an extent it captured that fear of going back, the emotional scars that it could bring up going back, the difficulty of it all, that emotional heft. I did find it far more reaching with his conversation with Melissa Leo than, say, going back. But at least the comfort, being able to sit down and watch the ocean from where he is and having those memories, it somewhat, to an extent, resonated with me. And I see what you're saying. Maybe it could have been fleshed out a little bit more, but I got what they were saying. And if things were going to go back home, you know, maybe he was one step closer to being almost healed.
Yeah. Well, the reason to me, like, he almost went there was less about the fact that it was home, more so that he knew the terrain and he knew that it was going to be evacuated. So it's basically this large playground. And furthermore, he has the weather. Granted, it's against him too, but I feel like he's calculating and therefore can turn that into an advantage for himself rather than a disadvantage,
right,
like for those other people.
So, and just for setting purposes, they set this hurricane in, of all places, Marshfield, in the Marshfield neighborhood of Brant Rock, which is located on the South Shore of Massachusetts. It's about an hour drive from downtown Boston, and taking place during daylight hours. It took almost a month to film the hurricane sequences there, which makes sense because they utilized a lot of ground where in the first movie the climax comes in a Home Depot type of a store. So that just lent itself to all of the items that McCall can weaponize. And that's why I say it sort of kind of did turn into a Friday the 13th-ish kind of climax violence, where this one, there's a lot of ground to cover, going into convenience stores, going onto rooftops over here, going to a lighthouse thing. It opened it up more in scope. And I loved the waves crashing in, flooding the town. And that's just one more element that our characters had to contend with.
Absolutely. And the fact that rather than, you know, all those places you mentioned, we get a scope of the landscape for everyone. When when they're searching for him, you see how they're searching. They're not just zoomed in on a particular thing. Like they're really seeing the scope of everything. Be like, where is he?
Right.
And the fact that in the backdrop of all of this is the hurricane, and they were able to make it all work visually. Yeah. Rather than that, I thought that was the most impressive action set piece I've seen in a while.
Yeah, and you know, the actors were actually yelling. Fuka even is known to be said. He says you can't hear the dialogue over the fans, but the actors have to give a performance. So I found that interesting. They tried to do they captured as much of that sequence with practical effects and in doing everything in camera. You don't know if a visual effect will be able to capture all of the little nuances you want to capture. And if you look closely, every shutter in town is banging and moving. And he goes, and I didn't want to have to rely on visual effects for that. You know, so, you know, there are times, I guess, with the water or whatnot, but I haven't quite seen, I know that there's this movie called The Hurricane Job that came up within the past year, but I haven't seen necessarily like a shootout. Like, when you think about it, this is a Western kind of a shootout.
Yeah.
Where the bad guys are coming into town looking for the good guy, and he's got to dispatch each one of them, and we're just going to throw in a hurricane. Like, well, I mean, category five.
You know, in a Western, it'd be more like a sandstorm. So
sure,
it's on par thematically.
So
it's all there, and it works so well.
Yeah, and they actually used Hurricane Sandy, which actually took place in Burnt Rock, but they took footage from Hurricane Sandy as their inspiration to try to get the aspects right. So. Waves and winds were a key, says special effects coordinator Jeremy Hayes. So they watched a ton of YouTube videos. Yeah. What the internet can do today.
Yeah. It must be an ominous feeling to have to watch all that footage.
Yeah.
Knowing what, obviously, that hurricane actually ended up doing. So always quite interesting.
So, I mean, and if you're curious too, because I found this interesting. So, Antoine wanted to create like wave after wave after wave, which you get that if you've watched the movie, right? And so they came up with this system that would allow them to continually fill individual cones that were used to fire the cannons of water. So, they had 1,600 CFM air compressors that provided air to the pressure tanks. They had a total of 24 individual cannons that we pieced together so we can aim them in different directions depending on where the camera was placed. That's a lot of water.
That
coming
is.
At a high intense speed.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. Absolutely. And yet, for the most part, they shot everything, as you mentioned, very practically. A lot of it did take place in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. They did go to Istanbul, Turkey, to shoot some stuff. So you do get that sense of really being where they're supposed to be.
Right.
Which I appreciated, whether it's even Belgium.
But I think what's part of it, too, is when you focus... Take the seaside town, right? If you're a good director, you're focusing in on the action and the fighting, the escaping, right? So we're really not... That's what we're focused in on. So it's sort of kind of like a smoke and mirrors. If we're focused on that, and they're not showing as much of anything else, we can't discern what is a special effect and not a special effect. Because that's, you know, part of Fuqua's talent as a director, to do that. So
absolutely. And, you know, Oliver Wood... He's the cinematographer for this. Very talented guy. He was part of the Bourne Ultimatum. So he's, you know, he knows a thing or two at that point as far as action movies are concerned. They used Arri Alexa cameras for this, so they went digital. So that kind of makes it easier to play back and see all this various stuff.
Absolutely.
I really think they used the color palette of each setting quite well.
Yeah.
You know, bright when it needed to be bright, dark when it needed to be dark. I really appreciated it overall,
mm-hmm.
as far as what they were able to capture.
Same here. Yeah, I like the way the look of this movie was pretty decent, and it looks fantastic up on the big screen. And you really get the, again, because of the way that it was filmed, you actually get to see the action take place in front of your eyes. It's not really blurred out. It's not shaky cam. In a sense, it was, there were parts of it was almost artful, like an art house, you know, a movie that Antoine Fuqua was trying to do or put out.
A scene in particular, like, that utilized good camera movement, because it all had to be told visually at that point, right, was when, let's say, our bad guys or two bad guys come in to get Miles at McCall's apartment.
Right.
And the way they used the double mirror and so forth, and just the way they shot it and the intensity of it, where he's right there, and the only thing that's separating him is glass. That was done so effectively, both through the editing, both through the cinematography, and obviously the acting to achieve that.
Yeah, and you got the sense of claustrophobia. I mean, he's not living... he doesn't live an opulent lifestyle, right? He's very sparse in his apartment. In fact, it was this great scene. I want to go back because... So when the kid first comes over to his place... You know, he tells him, he tells Miles, he goes, "Hey, this is my apartment. Don't touch that. This is my home."
Like, hey, because they're making the pasta.
Yeah.
This ain't your mom's pasta.
This ain't your mom's pasta. Put that down. This isn't your home. It was his place. He knew it really well. And when that scene comes in and he's telling him on the phone, like, what to do, that was intense. That was intense, that little escape room that he had. I just felt he did get out a little bit too soon. Just stay there. Stay there until McCall comes home.
Yeah. Or just give it 10, 20 minutes.
Damn, kid.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as the ending, I don't know what your thoughts on it were, but I thought overall the pacing worked well. It's interesting how the A plot really didn't come into fruition until, like I said, 50th minute, which generally should happen by the 30th minute. And you have to be you have to know exactly what you're doing to be able to pull that off. And I felt maybe they didn't do it as quite as good as they could have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. It's sort of a long movie too. Clocks in close to 2 hours, and. Like, I'm glad that the A, B, and C plots were there because they delivered the humanity of it all. But to your point, like, yeah, I was wondering when this movie was going to get going. Unfortunately, again, due to the trailer and watching the trailer, you know that Melissa Leo character gets killed. And I'm watching the movie going, when's this going to happen? Like, when are we even going to see her? It's like, oh, so we see her. And even after we first see her, it takes us a little more time to get to that plot. So I don't disagree. I think it's a valid point. It was just – and I don't want to say that the pacing was awkward. It was almost as if they had a lot of stories to deal with. And I don't exactly know – I guess you just had to set up your other ones because they were going to be tied up. I don't want to say simply, but you had to meet all these other people first before we're going to the main crux, which is going to drive the rest of the story.
Well,
I guess.
I know the things were happening simultaneously, but I almost feel like just do that stuff first because it's interesting enough, and then get into that storyline and really start to ramp up. Because we were trying to do too many things simultaneously, I felt.
Yeah.
And then they both lost weight because it's like, okay, this, got to focus on this. Oh, but forget about that for now. Here's a little clue as to what's happening here. Okay, now keep that in the back of your mind. Now back to the emotional stuff. So it's not that it's a complex movie, but emotionally you still have to track these certain things.
Agreed.
And compartmentalize them, which you know, for a movie like this, sometimes it's like, I didn't come here for that necessarily.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the editor here, Conrad Buff, he you know, he's worked on movies like Shooter. He's worked on Terminator movies. He's worked with James Cameron. He's done movies like American Assassin, The Equalizer 2. So he knows his way around these type of action, thriller, drama genres. I just think from a writing standpoint, he even actually, he worked on Training Day, which again has many characters going on. But I think they wanted to, I don't know, it just seemed there was a lot of stories taking place that they wanted the audience to get involved with. I just don't know how you recut it, but it just goes back to what we were saying earlier. There could have been a little bit more about this team and the whys of it all, yeah, so to speak.
I mean, it's tough because we don't know honestly what got left on the cutting room floor and things like that. So, and even just in the script process, what in and of itself got changed.
Sure.
Which, by the way, you know, I know we opened up the show with it, but it is something to note. The fact that this is, like, out of all things that Denzel has done and could have done, that this is the sequel that, you know, he said yes to.
Mm-hmm.
And Antoine very deliberately said, like, hey, if there's a good script and if Denzel wants to do it, then we'll make a sequel.
Denzel has said, too, he said this publicly, that he really doesn't consider this a sequel. Even though it is called Equalizer 2, he considers it a movie. Like, it's a stand. Like, he doesn't. He didn't look at it, approaching it, he didn't look at it as a sequel other than it's just a movie. So.
Well, and I could say from that standpoint, it does work as a standalone. Mm-hmm. You get that he lost his wife. He had this job, now he doesn't. And this is what he's doing. Oh, and the past essentially comes back to haunt him.
Yeah.
So to speak.
And if you haven't seen Equalizer, if you haven't seen the first one, you go back and you'll see Melissa Leo's character and Bill Pullman's character. This movie, I really, and again, to his point of it being a movie, I think that's why Melissa Leo, well, she played a bigger part. But it wasn't just they didn't rely on an audience having memory of the first movie. It was, in a sense, as if they were coming on screen and we're seeing them for the first time. Mm-hmm. And if you had seen the first movie, great. But if you hadn't, we're going to give you a little bit more information about these characters so that you can become involved and you'll know that there's a relationship here so that when this character dies, you understand the reasoning. So it's not like they just brought Melissa Leo in to have her death scene.
Yeah.
Because people are going to remember her from the first movie. That could be a part of the pacing as well, you know, shooting it that way so that you, for example, you didn't see the first one. You don't need the memory of that character for the first one. You understand. So when she does die, you understand the motivations of McCall.
Yeah. So. I don't disagree with that at all. I thought it worked out.
Yeah.
As far as that, that worked really well.
Sure.
Their relationship was very strong.
Yeah.
100%. I had a train of thought, and then I lost that train.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, I'm going to stall.
It's okay. Where do we want to go? Did we want to talk about numbers and?
Well, let's talk music about a little bit.
Sure.
The composer of the original returns for this one, Harry Gregson Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's an interesting fellow. He's done various movies like Ridley Scott's Prometheus, for example. But then he's also done a lot of video games. So he's got an interesting kind of combination of what he's done. And I appreciate that he's kind of come back. Because I didn't see the first one, I can't compare the two soundtracks. I don't know, maybe you can.
Very similar. I think if we're talking composers, if memory serves, and I think I'm pretty right, that the television series, The Equalizer, the music was composed by Stuart Copeland, drummer for The Police. I was surprised that why wouldn't you bring him back do the movie because he has a lot of cinematic. He has a lot of movies under his belt too. I found that the music in this was, it's as we described last week when we talked about Skyscraper. For the movie, it was fine. It never overshadowed. It never overpowered a scene. It never became bigger than the scene that we were seeing, but it added to the action, to the suspense. I thought it was pretty decent. And yeah. It had the hints of that Equalizer theme.
Absolutely.
Throughout.
So. I didn't remember what I was going to say. There's statistics online that if you put Denzel, give him a gun and a purpose, people will go see the movie.
Really?
And as far as promotion, like, you know, you look at the trailers and so forth, like, that's what the first Equalizer promised, and certainly this promised more of the same.
Uh-huh. Training Day, Man on Fire.
Yeah, like, people just love Denzel in that type of role.
They do. Yeah. I think people, though, I mean, he can get away. Look, Fence is not going to do as much as this, but there is something about him. He has a star quality to him, for sure. And it's something that is rare in movie stars today. And Denzel, I read earlier today, he doesn't like to be called a movie star. He's an actor. I respect him. I'll give him that. But his star quality is the moment he steps up on screen, he has a presence. Whether he's playing a dirty cop, a cowboy, an anti-hero here, have a heart, he's playing a comedy. He just, as soon as he comes on screen, you're gravitated to him. His humanity works. I mean, there is a reason why in the movie Game Night they chose Denzel Washington. He is able to bring people like him on all quadrants, whether you're male, female, doesn't matter the race. He brings them in. People like to watch him on screen. Yeah. And he's had his career, his longevity is just insane.
And you brought up Fences. I know it's not like this box office juggernaut, but it's a movie that he also did direct.
Sure.
So it's interesting. I would like to see him direct more.
Me too.
You know, and but I think he's learned a lot along the way. And, you know, working with Antoine, I think they have a good collaboration going, and I think he's able to learn a lot just from him. And conversely, like, you know, if Denzel wants something, it's like, hey, here's a good idea. Rather than, you know, we've talked about it before, the infamous Cruz one, like, hey, you will be an actor.
Right.
I am the director. It's the like, director. No, it's like a good, you know, it feels like these guys, like, a good idea is a good idea.
Yeah.
You got your role, I got my role. But let's collaborate.
Let's talk, since we're talking Denzel right now, right? I'm going to go back a bit. You have to talk about this guy's career. Crimson Tide. He goes up against Gene Hackman. I don't know the last time you saw Crimson Tide, but it's a great movie. Really good movie, not necessarily carrying a gun. He's in the movie Pelican Brief. Philadelphia. Yeah. Right? Malcolm X, of course. He was in the movie Ricochet. Mo Better Blues. He's done a couple of movies with Spike Lee. This movie called, I called it Have a Heart, Forgive Me. It's called Heart Condition, in which it's a comedy. It's paired with George Segal. I'll tell you, it's one of his first movies. It's called The Mighty Quinn. I highly recommend. But when you look at this guy's career, Devil in a Blue Dress, where he plays it's fantastic. Courage Under Fire, The Preacher's Wife, I know a lot of people like
Fisher.
Antoine Fisher, Fallen, which was more or less like a supernatural-ish sort of kind of a horror movie, The Siege, The Bone Collector, Remember the Titans, he can play, a football coach.
Great movie.
You know, John Q, not one of my favorite movies. Out of Time is actually a really decent suspense thriller. Man on Fire, we talked about, The Manchurian Candidate. Look at all these movies. Yes, some of them are action, but when you look at the different characters that he's playing, or like, he's not pigeonholed into playing your archetypical action hero star. Even movies like Deja Vu, or he'll play a bad guy in American Gangster.
And just even the simple way he's shot, like, you could look at I don't know, let's say Robert De Niro as Iron Man, or even like Eastwood
Robert
as
Downey Jr.
Yeah.
You mean?
Yeah.
Oh, you said De Niro.
Oh. What? You know what?
I was like, he was Iron Man?
Yeah, you know, back in the day. He ate a lot of iron.
He did.
He was a man. So, yes, Robert Downey Jr. Like, just the way they shoot Denzel is not your typical sort of superhero action star, you know, in that sense.
Yeah.
It's very different, and I think that's obviously part of what separates him.
Yeah, and he's able to play a regular guy put into extraordinary circumstances really well, too. Movies like Unstoppable. The movie's when you talk about a brisk-paced movie that really works, and you put him with Chris Pine in this, I believe it was Tony Scott. He made a lot of movies with Tony Scott, too. It was really good, and then he's in Safe House. So he plays against Ryan Reynolds, a Flight. Plays a far more dramatic character, and that was a Robert Zemeckis movie. I mean, this guy has done a lot. He's been around for a while, and I just think that, you know, yes, some movies make more money than others, but ultimately, people have really come to like him, no matter all walks of life.
Well, so let's talk about that, because initially, Equalizer 2 wasn't supposed to do as well as it did.
No.
And as we mentioned, it opened up number one at the box office, which, granted, maybe not, you know, you look at something like Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, not necessarily the biggest competition, although that, you know, relative big movie.
You are definitely splitting an audience. You're going for specific audiences with those movies.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have the third one, Unfriended, Dark Web. That's, you know, it wasn't going to open big, but, it, you know, in contention there. And the fact that it pulls off what it did, first off, it doubles its third Thursday night previews, essentially, from 1.5 to 3 million, give or take. So it doubles. Most movies, generally, that we talk about, the sequel kind of drops a little bit. Unless you're a Marvel movie, then you do maybe better.
Yeah.
But not your standard sequel. That, so kudos there.
Well, yeah, but plus I think they just... whatever the tracking figures were, I think it was underestimating the power of Denzel. The other weird thing about this, too, that I felt when we talk about marketing this movie, it was marketed really weirdly, I felt. We didn't really... I knew the movie was coming out, but Sony, for whatever the reasons, didn't start in earnest until, like, this movie came out... July 20th, they didn't really start in earnest until like the 4th of July weekend, like the first week, last weekend of June, first week of July. That's when we really got like our first trailer. That's when we started seeing stuff on this. And this is a Denzel, Antoine Fuqua. I almost felt as if Sony didn't have faith in the project enough that had they started promoting this and seeing some semblance of a trailer in May or April. Certainly there were other movies that they could have trailered on. I don't know. It just seemed sort of odd to me as a person who worked in that business to get trailers and marketing up in theaters. Like, it took them a long time, and they only gave themselves 3.5 to 4 weeks to do it.
Well, I don't know exactly when they switched the dates and so forth, but it was supposed to be... it was supposed to release September 14th of this year. Then they pushed it up to August 3rd. Then they set July 20th. So to what degree that affected all of them? I mean, it already seems like a cluster F.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, too. I think it could have benefited by opening on that August or September date. I think it could have helped it more. Not that it did bad, but it's like really interesting that Mamma Mia is going to get a specific audience. Denzel is going to bring in an action audience for sure, but he too will bring in a specific audience. He'll bring in an urban audience. He'll bring in women. Women love to see Denzel when he's playing a good guy. So I know the audience that I saw it with on that Thursday night preview night, man, they were like hooting and clapping, and they were so into it that I walked out going, why are they thinking this movie's going to do so low? Because they were thinking it might do 30. And it comes out and it does 36. It edges out Mamma Mia by about a million. It was an interesting box office race.
Yeah.
So
for sure. And, you know, on par, like, they estimate a $62 million budget, more like 70 plus marketing budget. I don't know. When you have 3.5 weeks, whatever that takes you up to.
Listen, if you're going around $62 million, which for Denzel Antoine Fuqua actioner, that's low.
Yeah, in that's word, really right?
And in fact, it's even lower because I was doing the research for Mamma Mia. Mamma Mia was like 75. It was more. And I'm like, what?
So, well, they had every actor to grace the earth.
But I'm like looking, this is an action movie. 62 is pretty, that's a respectable budget. You got to figure, probably 100, 110 million all in, Prince Advertising. I mean, they went out to 3,300 locations, almost 3,400 locations. You can tell that thus far they haven't fully gone, they haven't opened it up in all of their foreign territories because thus far it's only made about 3 million foreign. So worldwide we're at 50 million, and I think as the movie expands in the foreign territories, Denzel also has a presence internationally. That's why, to me, I know he doesn't want to be called a star, but he's a star. When you can carry an international, when you can come in domestically and everybody really likes you, like that is a star quality.
Certainly, and audiences as far as that, A- on CinemaScore. Yeah. Granted, on Rotten Tomatoes, it only has carrying a 51%. So, critics not seeing eye to eye with the audience right
now. Yeah, I don't quite understand the backlash for the critics. I certainly don't see it as a 50-51%. I mean, I think it's better than that. It's an enjoyable movie. Again, it seems, it's interesting that it's coming out in the thick of summer. And, you know, when you're looking what you're putting it up against, its second week is going up against Mission Impossible. That is Mission Impossible. And yeah. Literally, what are you thinking? And personally, after seeing Mission Impossible as well, I just think that the movie's going to over-index as well. So we'll see what happens. But I think that Equalizer 2 will stick around for a little bit.
I think so, too.
No.
All right. Well, any final thoughts before we wrap this anatomy up and get to Mamma Mia?
No. I mean, listen, I think Equalizer 2 is a decent sequel. Despite having some issues, from storytelling, I think it's a little more humanistic. I don't think it's as violent as many of the critics have lashed out against the violence of this movie. There are some brutal scenes, but I've seen worse this summer.
I've seen way worse.
Sicario was a very violent movie, and I thought this was even less violent than the first Equalizer. But again, Denzel proves that he can command presence. He can continue to do the action, and you believe in everything that he's doing on screen. And you add the humanistic part to it. I think overall, it's a worthy sequel.
Absolutely. I would be curious if they make a third. I would, if out of all the things that Denzel has done, this would be the one that continues on. It would be interesting, and I think it has merits to.
Me too.
I'm not saying I need it, but if he does it, I'd be curious to see it.
I'm in the same company with you. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But if he decides to, I'd say, okay, I'm fine with it.
Absolutely.
Good to go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we've been talking about this movie quite a lot, and we do that with a lot of movies. In fact, we've done it with over 400 in the archives. Speaking of a Denzel movie, we've done Fences.
I could swear that we did the first Equalizer.
I believe you guys did. I was on a part of that. We did Magnificent Seven.
We did.
So lots of movies, and not just those movies. If you like action in particular, we've done a lot of action. If you like comedy, we in fact tout comedies because they don't get the love we feel as much as they deserve, and everything in between. We've done musicals. In fact, we will be doing a musical for Mamma Mia right after this. And of course, in the coming weeks, we've got Mission Impossible Fallout, so lots to look forward to. So definitely continue, if you haven't already done so, subscribe now. That way you get all the latest episodes and you don't have to update yourself and be like, ooh, what was that movie? You get them all.
And comment as well. Indeed. As far as Mission Impossible, I say fall into your local theater, see it in as big a screen as possible.
Absolutely. And also, so one of the things I need to get better at is letting you know the movies that we will be doing. So Mission Impossible Fallout next week, and also we're looking to do Teen Titans Go to the Movies, so look out for that. In the meantime, at DMovies1701 is where you can interact with Dimitri more intimately, let's say.
And thank you, audience, for those who support me on Twitter.
And also meet the movie press on Popcorn Talk as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, they sent me to Comic-Con this weekend, and it's not happening. I came to find out, so I wasn't on Meet the Movie Press today,
but generally Bastards. He is generally he is. I'm at Phil Svitek, and our other co-host at Serafini TV, she's normally here, shout out to her. We'll see you guys next time. Bye
all.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.